So we are going to study, study the last part of essay number 4 in 1 Corinthians. I'm going to be reading and studying 1 Corinthians chapter 14, verses 26 through 40. And this is, the entire essay is in regards to women and men in church. We've been dealing with some of the things that happen in public worship. Paul has identified some problems that have been occurring in the Corinthian church in regards to public worship. And this is the last, well, actually two parts. Order in worship, the proclamation of the word, and women and men worshiping together. Part 6 and 7 of this essay number 4. And the kind of the theme that ties this last part together is keeping silent in worship. So let's begin by just reading through all of these last verses here. What then, brothers, when you come together, each one has a hymn, a lesson, a revelation, a tongue, or an interpretation. Let all things be done for building up. If any speak in a tongue, let there be only two or at most three, and each in turn, and let someone interpret. But if there is no one to interpret, let each of them keep silent in church and speak to himself and to God. Let two or three prophets speak, and let the others weigh what is said. If a revelation is made to another sitting there, let the first be silent. For you can all prophesy one by one, so that all may learn and all be encouraged. And the spirits of prophets are subject to prophets. For God is not a God of confusion, but of peace, as in all the churches of the saints. The women should keep silent in the churches, for they are not permitted to speak, but should be in submission, as the law also says. If there is anything they desire to learn, let them ask their husbands at home. For it is shameful for a woman to speak in church. Or was it from you that the word of God came, or are you the only ones it has reached? If anyone thinks that he is a prophet or spiritual, he should acknowledge that the things I am writing to you are a command of the Lord. If anyone does not recognize this, he is not recognized. So, my brothers, earnestly seek to prophesy, and do not forbid speaking in tongues, but all things should be done decently and in order. So we see that this last part is in three sections. The first part talks about, Paul addresses tongues and prophecies, their use in worship. Says that tongues are subject to interpretation and prophecies are subject to evaluation. In regards to tongues, he instructs the church members to keep silent if there is no interpreter. And to those who are speaking prophecies, the speaker is to give the floor to be silent if a new revelation is given. The purpose of both, tongues and prophecy, is for the purpose of building up the church. Maintain decent order during worship so all can hear and learn. In other words, exercise the gifts in love. And that, I think, and I believe, is the crux to interpreting this final part of essay number 4. So all can hear and learn. Now, this middle part, Paul addresses, is it women or wives? It's better translated as wives in this case, because of the instructions, you'll speak to your husbands later. So, at the very least, it's not universal to all women.
Only the married
ones.
She was trying to prevent him from embarrassing her husband.
So his instruction to the wives is to, again, maintain decent order during worship so all can hear and learn.
Yeah, I heard that the problem they were having is that people were disrupting the service by discussing the sermon while it was going on.
Wives should not interrupt. Wives should ask questions at home. So that is at the plain, at the surface reading, that's what it seems to be saying. And then the last part is essentially this whole thing is a summary of essay 4. You notice that in the actual text part from verses 37 through 40 in the square brackets, this is from Ken Bailey, he's noted how each of the previous parts of the essay are reflected. If anyone thinks that he is a prophet, that's chapter 11, or spiritual, chapter 12, he should acknowledge that the things I am writing to you are a command of the Lord, chapter 13. If anyone does not recognize this, he is not recognized. So my brothers, earnestly desire to prophesy, chapter 14, verses 1 through 12, and do not forbid speaking in tongues, verses 13 through 25. But all things should be done decently and in order, chapter 14, verses 26 through 33. So all spiritual gifts are given for the building up of the church. Love for one another is shown through the proper exercise of spiritual gifts. All spiritual gifts are valuable and necessary, and you are to desire them. Public worship should be done decently and in proper order. That is really what essay 4 is all about. It's about public worship. Number of additional preliminary observations. The essay, if you recall in chapter 11, opened with women and men both leading in worship. So Paul is not addressing in this last part whether women should lead or not. That's a given. Women are leading already. Mm-hmm. This section's concern is with men and women as worshipers, as part of the congregation. Mm-hmm. And recall that the center of the essay dealt with love as the vessel in which all activity takes place. The central concern for Paul is that worship must always lead to building up the entire community. Nothing that happens in worship should create or highlight existing factions and divisions. One of the problems in this essay that was highlighted was the problem of the Eucharist, the communion, where social divisions were brought to the fore because some were, the wealthy had more leisure time. And so they were able to come and enjoy the better part of the communion, of the food that was offered during their gatherings, where the poor who had to work and came later were kind of sequestered in the courtyard rather than the dining hall. Mm-hmm. And they only got the leftovers. And so Paul was against that kind of, when the church comes together, social divisions should not exist. Everyone should treat one another as equals, slave or free, Jew or Gentile, male or female, doesn't matter.
Don't do that.
I know.
No coughing.
No coughing, no sneezing.
Yep.
No falling yet.
Just don't do that.
I blame carrying a bowl of food back to the car as I was off balance.
And paying attention to the
food. Yeah. Because I knew it was slick. I knew it was slick and I was careful. I was walking slowly, but wham!
And the glass dish landed right side up and was broken.
That's right. Oh. I protect what's valuable. Oh. Just like when I got in an accident with my bicycle was fine. That's right. My body can heal. The bowl cannot be fixed.
The bowl can be replaced. That's true.
I got stuck in her grave with old me. I was walking up to the dentist, Kelly's house, and it was really high heat. And I I got about halfway up the driveway and ran out of crusty snow. So I was stuck.
Oh.
I was stuck. I couldn't go anywhere. I couldn't walk up more, and I couldn't go across to get to the dry patch on the other side, and I was just stuck there for a while. And finally, I just kind of had to shimmy up the driveway in complete ice on, you know, slope.
No.
And look for every little rock with a baby in my hands because I couldn't go back down.
Oh my goodness.
You know, I'd gotten to that point of no return where I was walking on a thin little band of gravel right up against the bank, and then I ran out and I went, oh no. And so, and then I've slipped down that driveway on my side, my back, several times carrying the trash can down. I actually fell on top of the trash can one time.
But you didn't fall on the baby.
I didn't fall on the baby.
All right. So this first part, section A, tongues and prophecies and worship, verses 26 through 33. Now it begins, what then, brothers and sisters, when you come together, each one has a hymn, a lesson, a revelation, or a tongue, or an interpretation. Let all these.
In other words, the word we says brothers isn't necessarily brothers.
It is literally brothers, but it is a general term to mean brothers and sisters. Mm-hmm. It means worshipers. And this is not specifying an order of worship. You know, you begin with a hymn, then you go on to a lesson, and then a revelation, and then some tongues, and then interpretation. No, that's not what Paul is saying. These is as the list, all the lists that Paul has given in this essay, it's ad hoc. They're examples. They're just something, you know, kind of off the top of his head. These are things that are part of worship.
That people do in worship.
Each person there has one or more of these things to present.
So there's hymn, there's lesson, you know, which would involve reading of scripture and teaching. There's revelation, that's prophecy. And then there's tongues, and then there's the interpretation of tongues. And the key is the primary purpose of worship is the building up of the church community. That's why the church comes together. So first he addresses tongues. Not all at once. Now in pagan worship, part of the ecstatic worship of in pagan type worship, well, it may have been that, you know, people were just yelling, screaming, talking, and all sorts of things all at once. Confusion. Paul is saying, no, that's not what you're supposed to do. What he's saying is, if you're going to speak in tongues, do it one at a time. And then two or three, each in turn, followed by interpretation. And there's this phrase at most. So it infers that tongues probably is supposed to be a minor part of worship if it happens at all. It's not supposed to be the main focus of worship. And if there is no one available to interpret, worship shouldn't include the use of tongues. You know, keep silent. That is Paul's admonition. Because as the earlier part of this essay showed, tongues edify only the person speaking. Now, it is a communication between the individual and God. The interpreter is the one who is able to then edify the rest of the congregation. So if the purpose of worship is to build up the entire congregation, and there is no interpreter, then tongues do not benefit anyone except the person speaking. Therefore, keep silent. Prophecy. Again, Paul says two or three at a time, in turn, followed by an evaluation of what was spoken. So what we understand, what we can glean from this is that prophecy is not New Testament prophecy is not to be understood as a, you know, infallible direct revelation from God.
Because it needs to be evaluated.
It needs to be evaluated by someone.
So we need discussion.
Discussion. Uh-huh. Kind of what we're doing here. Uh-huh. What Paul also writes is that revelation may come upon those who are seated and listening to members of the congregation. So there are maybe two or three who are up front, who have been given revelations, who are speaking one at a time. But then someone in the audience may, raise their hand or call out or do something to indicate that they too have a revelation, have some prophecy to give. Paul is saying, then give opportunity for all who receive revelations to speak. Unlike tongues, Paul doesn't say at most two or three. He just says two or three at a time. So the inference there is that there is no limit to the number of individuals who may prophesy. Just make sure that it is done in small numbers and then an evaluation of what was spoken.
But that might be more of a major part of the worship.
So this, Paul, throughout this essay, he has been saying desire prophecy. Prophecy is a valuable part, maybe the most important part of worship, because that is where God is inspiring someone to give knowledge and wisdom and instruction and encouragement. So if someone who is seated is given a revelation, has indicated that he or she wants to speak, then the ones up front who are currently speaking, they need to hurry up and finish what they're saying to give opportunity for the others to speak. In other words, prophecy is not a monologue. It's supposed to be a dialogue.
It sounds like they expected God to be there in giving thoughts or words or whatever to
lots of people.
Lots of people. Not just
The preacher, yeah.
There was no preacher, really.
Right.
The role of prophecy that Paul gives in these texts is that it's for teaching, and it's also for the encouragement of the church. And in this section A, Paul ends with, God is a God of peace, and this peace is shalom. Now, it's more than just absence of dissension or disruption or conflict. It's harmony. God is a God of harmony. And Paul says this is the practice in all of God's churches. Worship should be harmonious. It should not be marked by discord or turmoil. What's important to notice here is that there's nowhere in this passage or this entire essay where Paul establishes enforcement of this order. He doesn't set up hierarchy or authority to maintain order. He just believes it will naturally arise when the church acts in love. This is Gordon Fee in the New International Commentary. He writes, "What is striking in this entire discussion is the absence of any mention of leadership or of anyone who would be responsible for seeing that these guidelines were generally adhered to. The community appears to be left to itself and the Holy Spirit. What is mandatory is that everything aim at edification." And in another part, Fee writes, "Now Paul is arguing that the basis of all these instructions is ultimately theological. It has to do with the character of God, probably vis-a-vis the deities of the cults whose worship was characterized by frenzy and disorder. That theological point is crucial. The character of one's deity is reflected in the character of one's worship." So, another way of saying it is that how your corporate worship happens is a direct reflection of what you believe your God is like.
This is what God looks like. What we are doing here is what we believe God looks like.
It's a very structured, ordered, you know, we can't have any deviations kind of worship. That is
authoritative.
That's your view of God. If all you see, if all you see are men up leading, that's who you believe God is and what God values.
Or at least that's how the people are going to view God.
That suddenly creeps into your brain.
Yeah.
Without you even thinking it logically.
Now we get to this middle part, section B, wives in public worship, verses 33 through 36 of chapter 14. Verse 33 is a hinge verse. It goes both ways, so it summarizes section 8, but it also continues and introduces this next section. And this sets up the reason for Paul's admonition that follows. Something about the wives speaking during worship is disrupting harmony and contributing to turmoil and confusion. The question for us is, what was going on? Paul has already made it clear that women are certainly allowed to speak, you know, to prophesy, to speak in tongues, speak during and to lead public worship. So why this sudden turn of events here? Why does he give what seems like contradictory instruction?
Maybe the husband and wife's contentions with each other were getting in the way of worship.
So there are, from the Understanding the Bible Commentary, provides four hypotheses of what may have been going on. First is that, as a very literal reading, that Paul really did forbid wives, and possibly all women, to speak out during worship. The problem is, it goes against what he already wrote in chapter 11. So that's kind of, that needs to be dismissed. The second hypothesis is that it's a scribal gloss. In other words, later scribes and redactors added verses 34 through 35 as additional commentary, possibly based on what Paul is supposedly to have written in Ephesians, 1 Timothy, and Titus. Now, the Pauline authorship of these epistles are strongly disputed, so Paul may not have written those words. Or that they are genuine Pauline words that were moved to this position by redactors. Maybe they appeared earlier, maybe appeared later, maybe they were found in some other manuscript that scribes added later. The problem with this hypothesis is that it basically deals with the difficulty by ignoring it. You know, it's basically saying, well, we don't like it, so we'll just ignore it. And there is no good reason, no conclusive reason, evidence can be found to say that it doesn't belong here. Third hypothesis is that the Corinthian, that verses 34 to 35 are a Corinthian assertion. That's what the Corinthians were asserting, so that the wives should remain silent, and that Paul is writing against that. It's somewhat attractive. The problem is that, again, there is little textual evidence to support this hypothesis. Throughout Corinthians, Paul has introduced some of Corinthian believers' assertions. And it's in those cases, it's pretty obvious that they are assertions. But in this, in verses 34 through 35, there is no strong evidence that that is the case.
But traditionally, a lot of those assertions have been taken as Paul's.
True.
Paul's beliefs. And so,
we get to the fourth hypothesis, which is the historical cultural basis. That there were some kind of historical and cultural reasons behind Paul's instructions of verses 34 and 35. The problem here is that many scholars believe the reasons are mostly lost. We don't really know. Nevertheless, this instruction is not a general principle to be applied across all times, places, and peoples. In other words, it's not universal. It's specific to the Corinthian church for what was going on at that time. Now, what I am going to do here is I'm going to go into Kim Bailey's Paul Through Mediterranean Eyes and read it, basically read an extended part of that, of the chapter dealing with this, the commentary reading dealing with this, because he explains from his personal experience living among the people in, you know, this, in actually not this century, last century, 20th century. He reconstructs what he believes was going on in the Corinthian church. And the broad outline can be found in this C 1 through 13. So let me find that chapter. So this is chapter 4.7 in Paul Through Mediterranean Eyes, Cultural Studies in 1 Corinthians. Title of the chapter is Women and Men Worshipping. Subtitle, No Chatting in Church. And where do I begin? Okay. On the surface, this short homily appears to be in direct conflict with what Paul wrote in the beginning of the essay concerning the right of women to prophesy in the congregation. While resident in Corinth, Paul lived with Aquila and Priscilla. Priscilla, with her husband, taught Apollos, the well-known preacher from Alexandria. Luke, Paul's companion and colleague, recorded this for the church to read and ponder. Luke also recorded Peter's sermon at Pentecost, where God declares, "Your sons and your daughters shall prophesy." The quote from Joel chapter 2, verses 28 through 32 continues with, "Yes, and on my men servants and my maid servants. In those days I will pour out my spirit, and they shall prophesy. Not only will the sons and daughters of the house prophesy, but men servants and maid servants will step out of their places in the social order and join the sons and daughters in prophesying." In addition, Luke recorded the Song of Mary, and by so doing affirmed Mary as a teacher of theology and social ethics for the entire church for as long as his gospel is read. Women of some means were a part of the band of disciples that traveled with Jesus and the apostles. Among those women was Joanna, the wife of Chuza, Herod's steward. This wealthy, high-class woman helped fund Jesus and his traveling band. She also joined them and was present among the women at the resurrection. Luke records that on that singular occasion, the angel at the empty tomb told the woman, "Remember how he told you while he was still in Galilee that the Son of Man must be delivered into the hands of sinful men and be crucified and on the third day rise." The incident here described was either Luke 9 verse 18 or Luke 9 verses 43 through 45. In both cases, Jesus was addressing his disciples, and Joanna was among them. This confirms that she was one of the disciples. In Cenchreae, the eastern harbor of Corinth, Phoebe was the deacon. The word is masculine, not feminine. There were no deaconesses in the early church. They were all... Deacons were deacons, men and women. Uh-huh. She was not just one who served. She held the office of deacon. Elsewhere in the New Testament, the word diakonos is usually translated minister. Phoebe was clearly a leader, and most likely the leader, the minister, of the infant church in the harbor town near Corinth. Mary, the mother of Jesus, was last mentioned in Acts chapter 1, verse 14, as a pious woman meeting in prayer with the apostles, the women and the brothers of Jesus. The extent of her leadership role in the early church cannot be established historically, but to assume that she had no voice is unthinkable. The text of 1 Timothy 5, verses 1 and 2 can be translated, "Do not rebuke an elder, but exhort him as you would a father. Treat younger men like brothers, women elders like mothers, younger women like sisters in all purity." Is Paul in the text before us, speaking of now 1 Corinthians chapter 14, verses 33 through 36, overthrowing all of this? Writing to the Corinthian church, where Priscilla housed and fed him for 18 months, Is he insulting her by telling her to be silent in church? How can we understand this text? Anthony Thistleton offers a thorough discussion of the extensive debate concerning this passage. With a detailed analysis and specialized bibliography, he represents fairly the major views set forth in the current literature. For those eager to follow the details of the debate, Thistleton's 18 pages are a superb guide. I can but offer a few comments. This passage balances the overall essay on worship, which opens in 11 verse 2 and concludes with 14 verse 40. As observed with this passage included, seven sections form a prophetic rhetorical template with a climax in the center. The hymn to love in chapter 12, verse 31 through chapter 14, verse 1, is strategically placed in the middle to function as a healing flow of agape into the various problems discussed in the essay. If chapter 14, verses 33 through 36 is omitted, an abrupt hole is created in the set of seven carefully balanced sections. If it were missing, the reader would anticipate some other discussion regarding women and men in worship to balance Paul's opening discussion in 11, verses 2 through 16. Ben Witherington has astutely written, "It should be recognized that what an individual says to correct an error cannot be taken as a full or definitive statement of his views on a particular subject." This truism was observed when Paul wrote, "I want all of you to speak in tongues." As he recorded these words, he was trying to correct an error. He was not contradicting his earlier affirmation that God gives the spiritual gifts as he chooses, not as the believers choose. The key to the passage before us can perhaps be found in the composition of the church in Corinth. Corinth was the largest city in Greece and inevitably the most diverse. Manufacturing was extensive and the workforce was large, with commerce flowing north, south, east, and west, and with goods and small ships to haul across the 6-kilometer, 3.5-mile stone road, the Diolkos, that spanned the isthmus of Corinth. A great deal of slave labor was required. The biennial Isthmian Games would have brought in a further influx of internationals. Greek was their only common language. For the lower classes, enough Greek to function on the job would have been vital. But what about women at home? Whether the families involved were slaves, traders, day laborers, or skilled craftsmen, the languages spoken at home would have been numerous. Added to this was the problem of accent. Often, when a public speaker is functioning in a second language, even when the speaker is fluent, there can be great difficulty in communication due to accent. When a speaker's words and phrases are not understood, a low buzz can break out as listeners ask each other, "What did she say? What was that word?" The short attention span for simple people, like modern television addicts, was most certainly another problem. From 1957 to 1962, it was my privilege to be part of a team of Egyptian Christians engaged in teaching simple villagers in the south of Egypt how to read their own language, Arabic. The women, through no fault of their own, had a special problem. Due to their limited nature of their social contacts, their attention span, so I discovered, was about 15 seconds. For this reason, occasionally, I was obliged to teach no more than 3 women at a time. I broke the material I was presenting into 15-second segments. And in class, I would call the first woman by name and talk to her for 15 seconds. During those 15 seconds, the other 2 women were not listening. Instead, they were chatting among themselves, or to grandma in the next room, or to the neighbor 12 feet away, seated across the village alley, or to one of the children playing at their feet. After presenting my 15 seconds to the first woman, I would call the second woman by name and deliver the same 15 seconds of information to her. During this second recitation, the first woman's attention was elsewhere, as was the mind of the third woman. I would repeat the process for the third woman and then start over with the second 15-second segment. The women were intelligent, committed, and interested. In fact, they were the volunteer supervisors of the classes we had organized across the village. Having never focused their minds for an extended period of time on any topic, their attention span was naturally short. Understanding this, I was happy to meet them where they were rather than expect them to fit into my acquired pattern of speaking and listening. Large groups of simple, uneducated women presented special challenges. ancient cultures often developed a classical language and a colloquial language. I am personally acquainted with this reality in Arabic, Syriac, and modern Greek. The way people such as Paul and Apollos spoke formally in church was not necessarily the way Greek speakers talked to one another on the street and in private homes. We know Paul's written style, and Luke tells us that Apollos was an eloquent man. A very small percentage of people were literate across the Mediterranean world of the first century. I have read estimates as low as 10%. Naturally, we have no record of how people spoke because even personal letters were the work of that 10% who wrote in literary, Koine Greek. The first four verses of Luke's Gospel are a single polished sentence of 39 words. I am sure that the wives of illiterate dock workers in Corinth, listening in their second or third language, would not have been able to comprehend that sentence. A few Greek words, enough to buy food in the market, were likely the limit of their Greek vocabulary. I worked for decades with Westerners who served in the Middle East and who studied hard to acquire courtesy and survival Arabic and found themselves totally lost in an Arabic language worship service. Yes, the authors of the New Testament were not trying to imitate the classical Greek authors. They wrote in Koine, but yet. I have preached in village churches in Egypt where the women were seated on one side of the church and the men on the other. There was a wooden partition about 6 feet high separating the two sections. I preached in simple colloquial Arabic, but the women were often illiterate and the preacher was expected to preach for at least an hour. And we had problems. The women quickly passed the limit of their attention span. The children were seated with them and chatting inevitably broke out among the women. The chatting would at times become so loud that no one could hear the preacher. The villages had no electricity and no sound amplification. One of the senior elders would stand up and in a desperate voice shout, "Let the woman be silent in the church." And we would proceed. After about 10 minutes, the scene would repeat. I was encouraged by the fact that John Chrysostom of Antioch experienced the same problem. Preaching in the Cathedral of Antioch in the latter part of the 4th century, stenographers recorded the following words from Chrysostom. "And if they, the women, will learn anything, let them ask their husbands at home." Chrysostom, "Then indeed the women from such teaching keep silence, but now there is apt to be great noise among them, much clamor and talking, and nowhere so much as in this place, the cathedral. They may all be seen here talking more than in the market or at the bath. For as if they came hither for recreation, they are all engaged in conversing upon unprofitable subjects. Thus all is confusion, and they seem not to understand that unless they are quiet, they cannot learn anything that is useful. For when our discourse, the sermon, strains against the talking, and no one minds what is said, what good can it do to them?" If this was the scene in the cathedral of the great city of Antioch in the 4th century, what can we imagine in Corinth in the days of Paul? Paul had just affirmed that the Corinthians were getting drunk at the Lord's Supper and that the prophets and tongue speakers were all talking at once. It seems that some of the women gave up and started chatting. Who could blame them? Yet all needed to work together to create the required decency and in order necessary for meaningful worship. The women are consequently called on to be subordinated, but to whom? Clearly Paul means be subordinated to the worship leadership, and the reader knows that the leadership includes men and women prophets. Also relevant is the fact that chapter 14, verses 26 through 36 lists the three groups of people who are disturbing worship. These are the male and female prophets are told, don't all talk at once. Be silent in church. The male and female speakers in tongues are told, if there is no interpreter, be silent in church. Married women with Christian husbands who attend are told, don't ask questions during the worship and don't chat. Ask your husband at home and be silent in church. Each of these groups is told to be silent when it disturbs worship. Paul is not telling the female prophets discussed in chapter 11 to stop prophesying. But there is a further reality at play. Middle Eastern society is predominantly an oral culture. I experienced this for 17 years in Egypt, 17 years in Syria and Lebanon, and for 10 years in Israel and Palestine. People process information by talking more than by sitting quietly and reflecting. This can be observed at many levels of society. A university professor will have the attention of the class and turn to write something on the blackboard. The moment he or she pauses to write, the entire class breaks out talking. They are not inattentive or rude, they are simply turning to a fellow student and chatting about the subject. This social style is particularly prominent at meetings of women. Taking advantage of any pause, women will often begin talking out loud, sometimes to themselves. They are simply verbalizing the information they have heard in order to better absorb and retain it. Multiple factors must be considered. So, attention span problems, limited knowledge of Greek, accent issues, language levels of greeting use, lack of amplification for the speakers, along with chatting as a methodology for learning are all involved. The women slip into the list along with the tongue speakers and prophets. All three categories, when worship is disrupted, are asked by Paul to keep silent in church. Paul is saying, women, please stop chatting so you can listen to the women and men who are trying to bring you a prophetic word, but cannot do so when no one can hear them. Paul is very polite. Unlike Chrysostom, he does not say, you women chat more in church during the sermon than you do in the marketplace or at the baths. Some of the women, probably seated in linguistic groups, are no doubt asking their neighbors about the meaning of this or that word in Greek. Paul picks up on these legitimate questions and in effect says, I know your Greek is limited, but your husbands have learned a bit more Greek than you have managed to absorb. They have to in order to function on the job. You have not had this chance, and it is not your fault. But things have gotten out of hand on a number of levels. Please be helpful and put your questions to your husbands after you return home. I have just told the speakers when to be quiet. This is a situation in which you also need to listen quietly, even if you can't follow what is said.
What are you reading from? Is that written on this paper already?
No.
No. That's Paul through Middle Eastern eyes?
Paul through Mediterranean eyes.
Mediterranean eyes.
Cultural studies and 1 Corinthians.
I love that. He's used it quite a bit.
So that is Ken Bailey's reconstruction of what he believes was happening in the Corinthian church.
Mm-hmm. Paul is prophesying. Mm-hmm. I mean, Ken Bailey's prophecy. That's what he would have been doing in church while we were all there. Right? Like that's kind of what Paul's saying people were doing.
Right. And then, you know, Paul also writes, it is shameful for a woman to chat in church. For modern Westerns, shame has to do with somehow being bad or immoral or evil. For Paul, it carries none of those connotations. It's more of our, it's impolite. It's improper. It's a fairly neutral term. So Paul is not putting down women at all. He's not putting down wives. He's just saying, you know, tongue speakers, prophets, women, when you all speak while there's a speaker up front trying to give you a message, other people around you can't hear. They can't listen. So please be quiet. In section C, this is the closing comments. Paul touches, again, as we read through that, Paul touches on highlights from the beginning, all through essay 4. The center is this command of the Lord. Now, the problem is that frequently, when he says, he should acknowledge that the things I am writing to you are a command of the Lord. Frequently, this has been interpreted as pointing to the immediately preceding antecedent, which is wives speaking, wives chatting, wives be silent, Is that what Paul is referring to? It might seem that way, but as we can see from this rhetorical structure, what Paul is doing is he's recapping the essay. The command of the Lord is chapter 13. 1 Corinthians 13 is the primacy of love. So what Paul is saying is, Paul's point is that if love is not the primary characteristic of public worship, if concern for others is not the primary point of public worship, then there is no point to public worship. Everything that happens in public worship must be done with love and respect toward one another for the purpose of encouraging and building up the community. Anything that leads to division and or highlights existing differences must be left outside the church. From reading the New Testament commentary, this is final paragraph here. On the one hand, the Corinthian spirituals contended that some gifts were better than others, indicated that they wanted the higher gifts, took the position that tongues were a sign for unbelievers, prophecy for believers, and held that women should not occupy a leadership role in Christian worship. On the other hand, the apostle argued that there are a variety of gifts and that each one makes its own contribution to the common good, showed love to be the indispensable motivation for the manifesting of any gift, insisted that understandable speech is mandatory in corporate worship for both believer and unbeliever, and stood firm for the principle that Christian corporate worship is not a male-dominated enterprise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, I grew up going to an Adventist school and and all this where it says brothers, fathers, mm-hmm. men, and there's all through the Bible where it appears mm-hmm. to be talking about men. We were always told by our teachers what really means men and women. And I always thought, as a kid, I always thought, well, they're just saying that to make the little girls not, us girls not feel left out. And it wasn't until, like, many, 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 many years later when I actually experienced talking to people who didn't speak English very well. We have a word, we have the word sibling and grandparents mm-hmm. and grandmothers. Talking to Juan about his kids, he was, he's deported down there, and he has the four kids. Mm-hmm. And he tells me how he misses his sons. Very, very clearly not saying, I don't miss Janet.
Uh-huh.
I mean, he's talking, and he's talking about
his
kids.
About his children.
And his sons. Huh. They don't have a word in Spanish. Well, they have a word in Spanish for grandparents. It's grandfathers.
Uh-huh.
My grandfathers, if you're talking about your grandmother and your grandfather, they say
are by default masculine.
By default uh-huh. masculine. Uh-huh. And when a person that doesn't speak very good English and understand the language very well
uh-huh.
talks about their children, they say their sons. My father, they say uh-huh. their fathers. Uh-huh. Aida uh-huh. refers to her parents as her fathers. She knows now that in English we don't
there's
say
another
that.
Word.
Right. But I mean, they.
Yes, Spanish doesn't have a new.
It doesn't have a
neutral term.
Siblings.
Yeah.
It's brothers. Huh. She has five brothers.
Some of them
six
are
brothers. Brothers. Some of them are girls. But they're all her brothers. That's the way they talk. So
if they're speaking about one person, it's.
Sister. Okay. Right. Yeah, sister
but if it's more than one, then
right.
it's always
talking about their mother, they say mother. But if it's talking about both parents, they say fathers. And you know, we get hung up on that because we have words for these things, but in some languages, and I don't know the Middle Eastern languages, maybe mm-hmm. it's like Spanish where that's the word they have. I
It tends to be the language is where everything has gender, where they don't have a neutral gender.
Greek has gender. Has gender, has lots of tense, formal tenses, the verb tenses than English. And so it's hard to translate.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And do they have a separate word for siblings?
Yeah.
As to, like, brothers, sisters, siblings, like we have. And in Spanish, it's brothers, sisters.
You've said before that sometimes this word, that we read brothers, it means siblings or brothers?
Yeah, the word is adelphoi.
And?
It literally is brothers. That is the literal translation. It's a masculine term.
But it means, but it's the word used for siblings.
Yeah, brothers and sisters. It's the in context.
So like in Spanish. It's like in Spanish. Interesting. Where the word means brothers, but what it actually means is
in our language, in our society, we would never say brothers for brothers and sisters.
Well, we would say
fathers
kids
for mothers and fathers.
See, we would say kids.
Right.
Kids. Like in Spanish.
Yeah. Say siblings,
in Spanish,
kids,
when you say niños and niñas, that's your boys and your girls. But when you say kids, you say niños.
Right. Uh-huh. It's boys.
You just say niños.
Yeah, in English, most
but we all words we wouldn't say, we wouldn't say my boys and girls, we would just say our kids.
Right.
And so it's not the writer's aspect, it's just the language.
Right.
It's just the language.
And I didn't really understand
and
that.
We translate it literally, and we say brothers. And so we tell the women, oh, you don't count.
I seriously never really understood that until I talked to people that didn't speak very good English. Mm-hmm. That were speaking English with a Spanish, you know.
From a Spanish culture.
Yeah.
Actually, it may not be the person didn't speak very good English. It might be that
it might be that
he didn't understand their Spanish.
No, seriously, Juan does not speak very good English.
I'm joking about that because we would say, well, they don't understand us, but we might
sometimes
be not understanding
don't.
Their interpretation either.
Right,
like
it goes both ways. Sometimes
they're saying what they think is completely normal to them.
Right, it's not unusual to say something to Aida. And she truly does not understand you. She understands the words, but what you're saying is, it's just the concept doesn't compute.
So sister is the feminine form. It's Adelphi.
But they wouldn't say Adelphos and Adelphi.
Well, Jesus did say that. Matthew 12, verse 50, for instance.
So
for whoever does the will of my Father in heaven is my brother and sister and mother.
They can say that.
They can.
But sometimes,
often,
specifically included.
Right.
But the word generally used is the inclusive masculine.
In our language and culture, if someone said men, they would mean males. Period.
Preachers use brother all the time in their sermons addressing their entire congregation.
Yeah. Well, because they understand that that's the way that Bible talks, so
they
people know what they mean.
A lot of times you hear just, you hear it one way or the other. I mean, it's a verbal term that we all understand, so if somebody's speaking to a group of people, they don't necessarily always have to reiterate the male-female form of it. They're just speaking to their overall congregation.
But that's Bible language. That's not English.
And so,
American culture language. That's Bible language.
Some of the more gender-inclusive translations include the NIV 2011, the Common English Bible, the New Living Translation, and some of these have the New Revised Standard Version. But these have also are not very popular with a large segment of Christianity because it is gender inclusive.
And a lot of fundamentalists
learned it from their perspective, from what the Bible says. When it says men, it means men.
Now, for example, the Common English Bible, the phrase "Son of Man" is translated "human one."
Son of humanity.
No, because son is masculine.
Oh, right.
Human one.
Human one.
humanoid.
Jesus.
It's so odd that we contorted a message of like equality and freedom for humanity into equality and freedom for men.
Uh-huh. Well,
you know, it doesn't make any sense that so here's this relinquishing of shackles to the sins of mankind.
Yeah. Well, it goes back as early as the third and fourth generation of Christians. Back in the second and third centuries, these early church fathers coming out of Platonism and such, which devalued women. They brought those ideas into
Christianity.
Into Christianity.
Any culture that a person is from is going to influence how they say it. They just did.
So it goes back to, pardon me, it goes back to the thing that I keep saying or asking is that this Christ's church and his disciples' ideology and the message that they tried to bring to that world at that time was so brief. It lasted almost seconds in comparison to the overall scheme of what we're, and so now it's just this constant trying to get back to the almost utopian church that they had for a split second that died almost instantly after those apostles were gone. After the people actually.
When you look at the Corinthian church, and you know we can see that. Even while the apostles were alive,
right. Well,
it had severe problems. So you might say that there was never a perfect church.
And I don't mean to laugh, but I think about that, and it's ironic to me that it took literally like nanoseconds for people to completely forget that, you know, this is what.
Yeah, there was maybe the one perfect church. Existed at the cross, at the foot of the cross,
right.
Where you know the women and John were gathered in the upper room,
uh-huh.
Where the disciples, and that would include the women as well, were gathered,
uh-huh.
And maybe the very first few chapters of Acts.
Yeah, the women in the picture.
Beyond that, it is a story of the gospel going out to the world, but also all the problems that brings in.
Uh-huh. But the gender thing, you know, when God became human, by necessity, he had...
Yeah, because there is a genderless human...
There was required a gender. That wasn't the important part of his humanness.
Right.
But it had to be there, and it influenced.
If it had been more ambiguous, then everybody would have said, "Whoa, what's going on?" And that would have been the defining characteristic of that person.
Ambiguous, they go, "Whoa, what's going on?" You can't have ambiguous.
That would have been the defining characteristic,
right,
of that person.
Right. And female, yeah. I don't know.
And he was trying to not make it the defining character.
Right. But there it was. And could it be? I mean, yeah. It is to this day.
So, in what scholars today accept as genuine, basically undisputed Pauline writings, Paul is very inclusive. Paul is very egalitarian.
Well, he always has been, because he's always been breaking down those boundaries from the Judaism or the Jewish ideology that he, you know, he was the first to go sit with the Christians, or he was the first to you know, follow these parameters, but still think it's okay for them to be Jewish. And I mean, he's been doing that since I've been introduced to him. I've seen no sign of him ever saying there should only be one ideology, you know, one group of people doing this one way. So
Plato, is he the guy that said that women are the source of sin because of Eve and the apple?
No, Plato is Greek. There were some Jewish rabbis who were like Ben Sirach, who was extremely anti-women.
Uh-huh. You were saying in the second and third centuries or something like that, the Plato people...
The Stoicism, kind of the whole idea of Stoicism and things like that, they were... they devalued women.
Hmm. Okay. And that came from Plato?
Yeah.
Okay.
It also spans for a long time in history because men of power were always trying to devalue women because it inhibited their ability to be as powerful as they were because the temptations of a woman are so meager in the idea of this great powerful people but can just tear down whole communities of powerful men with just the problems of sexuality in general.
It's all about power.
It is. It really is because people there's man groups that practice chastity or those things, abstinence for the specific act of keeping their power over women, uh-huh. like and their power over the world, like they cannot be swayed by that. So uh-huh. it has a lot to do.
So they will not be influenced by this female power group.
Women have the power by being by their
seducing them for them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Huh. Well,
yeah, it's interesting.
Or even losing their ability to back each other. So men, you know, they in their little groups, these highly powerful groups, they do that so that there isn't a temptation between the two men to lose their ability to take care of each other or do the things that they're supposed to do. Because in some cases, the devotion of men to each other was so great that they had, it was more than their wives and their families, their devotion to their group and to each other. So it was important to make those gestures.
Yeah. So what we have seen in 1 Corinthians is that Paul breaks the social norms in regards to gender relationships. He affirms that being single is an okay way of life. And we saw that in essay 3, was it?
Mm-hmm.
Being single is okay. And he in this essay 4, he writes that the women can lead. You know, it's okay for women to lead. But it's not okay for them to disrupt when other women and men are leading.
Right.
But what has happened is that the church has often taken that little two verses in chapter 14 and tied it with the one verse that comes a little later and elevated that to kind of a universal command that women, and particularly wives, need to be submissive and remain silent in church, and therefore, by implication, they cannot lead.
And even though the church allows women to do a lot of things, mustn't ordain them, because that would be going against the leading. I guess they keep that one little thing back in order to be sure that they're following the Bible.